Only as the lock begins to turn do I notice that one of the tiny panes of colored glass is missing, not broken, just not there. I frown, pushing the door wide open, and standing frozen on the threshold of the house I have loved for 30 years. My handsome wife brushes past me with a whispered, "Sorry, but I gotta go," and I feel her transferring Bentley's hand to mine. Kimmer is 3 steps into the house before she too stops and stands perfectly still.
"Oh no," she whispers. "Oh, Misha, oh no."
The house is a disaster. Furniture is upended, books are strewn over the floor, cabinet doors broken, rugs sliced to ribbons. My father's papers are everywhere. While Kimmer waits in the front room with Bentley, I force myself to go upstairs. I discover that the 4 bedrooms are barely disturbed, as though there was no need to bother, I am thinking as I stand in the window of the master suite, telephone in hand, talking to the police dispatcher. As I explain what has happened, I realize something isn't right. They did not wreck the 2nd floor, as though ransacking the 1st floor was enough. As though they found what they were looking for. Now, more puzzled than frightened, I go back downstairs to join my wife and son, who, wide-eyed, are hugging each other in the living room. The police, arriving in minutes from their quaint headquarters a block away, quickly pronounce the destruction the work of local vandals, teenagers who, unfortunately, spend much of the winter trashing the homes of the summer people. Kimmer eagerly accepts this explanation, and I am quite sure the insurance company will too. And more important, the White House. Vandals. Of course, they were vandals. The kind of vandals who destroy 1 floor of the house and ignore the other. The kind of vandals who steal neither stereo nor television. The kind of vandals who know how to circumvent my late paranoid father's state-of-the-art alarm system. And the kind of vandals who are in direct contact with the spirits of the departed. For I do not tell either my wife or the friendly police officers about the note I found upstairs while waiting, sealed in a plain white envelope left on top of the dresser in the master bedroom. My correct title and full name typed neatly on the outside. The perplexing message on the inside written in the crabbed, spiky hand I remember from my childhood when we would proudly leave copies of our school essays on the judge's desk and wait for him to return them a day or so later. With his comments inked redly in the margins, demonstrating what idiots our teachers were to award us A's. The note on the dresser is from my father. Many years ago, when as a child I first visited the town of Oak Bluffs, I at once became entranced by the grand old wooden building at the foot of Circuit Avenue, housing the Flying Horses, which bills itself as the oldest carousel in America. Ordinarily, on the 3rd afternoon of a vineyard sojourn, I would be at the Flying Horses with my son. But it is autumn, and the carousel is closed for the season. Fortunately, the island offers other diversions. Yesterday, as a hastily assembled cleanup crew tried to put Vinard Howes back in some kind of order, the 3 of us spent a marvelous afternoon walking the breathtaking ancient cliffs at Gayhead in the chilly November air, picnicking at the perfect pebbly beach in the fishing village of Menemsha. This morning, Bentley and I dropped Kimmer at the airport for her flight back to the mainland. Bentley and I are staying on because we need to. Kimmer has work to do. I have a week or so of leave left, and Bentley needs some rest and recreation. Right now, my son and I are preparing to go to the playground, or more precisely, Bentley is ready, waiting for me. I am less ready. I am sitting at the table in our newly cleaned kitchen, the note from my father flattened on the surface, willing its secrets to reveal themselves. In the next room, Bentley is watching the Disney Channel. Last night, as my family slept uneasily, I wandered Vinard Howes from the foyer to the attic crawl space, searching for something. But I do not know what. I need a clue. Unfortunately, the most obvious clue, my father's note, remains gibberish. My son, there is so much I wish I could share with you. Alas, at the present moment, I cannot. I have asked a good friend to deliver this note should anything befall me. If you are reading my words, one must assume that something has. I apologize for the complexity of this method of contact, but there are others who would also like to know that which is for your eyes only. So know this much. Angela's boyfriend, despite his deteriorating condition, is in possession of that which I want you to know. You are in no danger, neither you nor your family, but you have little time. You are unlikely to be the only one who is searching for the arrangements that Angela's boyfriend alone can reveal. And you may not be the only one who knows who Angela's boyfriend is. Excelsior, my son. Excelsior. It begins. Sincerely, your father. The handwriting is unmistakably the judge's, as is the flowery, overwrought, self-important prose, even the formality of the signature. Quite unexpectedly, my fury at my father threatens suddenly to overwhelm me. If you want to tell me, tell me. Jack Ziegler in the cemetery demanded to know about the arrangements. Now, at last, I know for certain that my father actually made some. But I do not know what they are, and this hint, this clue, this post-mortem letter from my paranoid father lends me no assistance at all. Excelsior! Angela's boyfriend, despite his deteriorating condition? What is all this? One point is clear. Not McDermott's mission in Elm Harbor was neither to apologize nor to reassure, but as I suspected, to see whether I know an Angela or not, which means that he is somehow privy to the contents of this letter. I wonder if the letter was the reason for the destruction of the first floor, except that I cannot quite fathom why they would break into the house, find the letter, and then leave it behind. Or for that matter, how the letter got here in the first place. Presumably McDermott, if he was even here, would not have dropped it off. The judge wrote that he asked a good friend to deliver it should anything befall him. But what good friend would break into Vinard Howe's to drop it off? Why not mail it to my house or bring it to my office? Why not deliver it to the soup kitchen? Could the pawn be connected to the letter? Did my father arrange that delivery as well? If he wanted me to have the pawn, wouldn't he have delivered the pawn and letter together? Not that it matters, for my father's note is actually no help at all. I have a terrible memory for names, but it is good enough for me to be sure that I do not know an Angela, and I have no idea who her boyfriend could possibly be.
Playground, now, 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 Bentley calls. Dare you?
1 minute, I shout back, still puzzling over the letter. How am I to locate Angela's boyfriend, who is in deteriorating condition? Does that mean that the man I should be talking to is sick, perhaps dying? Is that why I have little time? I know who the others are, who would also like to know, having met a pair of them, but I do not understand why the judge is at such pains to assure me that my family is in no danger. The fourth such reassurance I have received in the past month. First Jack Ziegler, then McDermott, next Agent Nunzio, now my late father. I shake my head.
Playground now,
Bentley announces from the doorway to the kitchen, stomping his foot. I look up at him, ready to be angry, and smile instead. He is wearing his midnight blue parka and has even pulled his sneakers onto the wrong feet. He is dragging my windbreaker behind him. Oh, how I love this child. Okay, sweetheart. I fold my father's letter, return it to the envelope, and slip it into my pocket. Playground now. Bentley jumps up and down.
Playground, dare you? Wav you.
Wav you too? I hug him and kneel down to fix his shoes. I'm sorry, sweetheart, I say to Bentley, as we sit in the booth waiting for our cheeseburgers.
Playground, moans my son. Go playground.
It's too late, buddy, I murmur, tousling his hair. He shrinks away. See, it's dark outside.
You say playground. Dare you?
His tone is understandably accusatory, for I have committed one of those parental sins that children, in the innocence of their youthful integrity, find it all but impossible to forgive. I broke my promise to him. We never made it to the playground. Because before leaving, I made the mistake of checking my office voicemail. I found two frantic messages from a lawyer at a New York firm that recently retained me as a consultant. I was tied up for the next 90 minutes, plying my poor son with cookies and fruit to keep him relatively quiet, promising myself every 5 minutes that I would be done in five more. When I informed Bentley that it was too late to swing by the playground, he literally fell to the floor in tears. Nothing theatrical or manipulative, nothing fake. He simply put a hand over his face and crumpled, like hope dying. And so I pulled the other sad, spoiling trick of the contemporary parent. I bribed him. We bundled into our parkas and walked the two blocks from Vineyard House to Circuit Avenue, the commercial heart of Oak Bluffs. We made our way down to Murdoch's Candy Shop, my son's second favorite place on the island, ranking just behind the incomparable Flying Horses, to buy some of the cranberry fudge that is a specialty of the house. Then we meandered back up the street. I bought the local paper, the Vineyard Gazette, at the corner store, and we stopped in for dinner at Linda Jean's, a quietly popular restaurant of unassuming decor and remarkably inexpensive food, and at one time, my father's favorite place to eat. Some years ago, on the 10th anniversary of my father's humiliation, Time did a story about his life since leaving the bench. The main theme of the story was that, despite the frenetic activity that marked his days, my father was far lonelier than even many of his friends realized. The magazine noted that he was spending more and more time at his summer home in Oak Bluffs, nearly always by himself. And although Time made the house sound far grander than it is, the article caught the tenor of his life exactly. The piece was titled, with faint, depressing irony, The Emperor of Ocean Park. Hey, buddy, I say now to my beautiful son.
You say,
Bentley whispers. His big brown eyes are sleepy. Not only did I break my promise, but I forgot his nap, and I am feeding him too late. I'm quite sure there must be good fathers in the world. If I could meet one, maybe he could show me how to do it right.
They're mommy,
he replies. Perhaps a hope, perhaps a preference, perhaps a threat.
Mommy kiss. Dare you.
I wink at Bentley, and he grins back, chewing thoughtfully on a French fry. I unfold the Vineyard Gazette and nearly choke. Private investigator drowns at Menemsha Beach, the headline blares. Police consider death suspicious, the next line informs us. Staring up at me from the right-hand side of the page is a very bad photograph of a man the newspaper identifies as one Colin Scott. But I knew him somewhat better as Special Agent McDermott.
You know, he was indeed a private investigator based down in South Carolina, says Cassie Meadows. And Scott really was his name.
Oh, so now they're willing to tell us his name. Nice of them.
I'm not sure why they wouldn't tell us before.
Well, now that he's dead, they don't have a choice, do they? I mean, his name was all over the papers up there. It is Monday, 4 days since I opened the Gazette and saw the picture of Colin Scott, 3 days since I hopped the first ferry of the morning and rushed home. I don't get the idea the FBI is actually being all that helpful on this, I tell Meadows bitterly.
Mr. Corcoran thinks the Bureau is doing all it can.
So if the FBI is being so helpful, have they explained what Scott was doing out in that boat?
Oh, he was keeping an eye on you, no question about that.
Swell.
Meadows laughs, but gently. I don't think you have to worry about him anymore, Misha, if you see what I mean.
I make a small sound of assent.
The Bureau doesn't think his friends had anything to do with it,
she continues, her tone conversational. She seems amused by the whole thing.
They were just fishing buddies from Charleston. They told the police that Scott had been drinking, and when he fell overboard and they couldn't find him, they kind of panicked. So they returned the boat and ran off.
But they came back.
Later, when they were a little less drunk. Anyway, the Bureau raided Scott's office down in Charleston, and guess what? They found his diaries and some files, and it looks like he told you the truth. Somebody did hire him to recover papers that your father supposedly had in his possession when he died. Unfortunately, the diary doesn't say who hired him to do it, or what the papers were exactly.
If he wouldn't trust the name of the client to paper.
Oh, I see. You're thinking about Jack Ziegler, I guess.
That would be correct.
Well, Misha, you shouldn't worry about Mr. Ziegler. Mr. Corcoran told me you would probably think Mr. Ziegler had something to do with hiring Mr. Scott. Mr. Corcoran asked me to tell you that he spoke to Mr. Ziegler, and that Mr. Ziegler denied hiring Mr. Scott, and Mr. Corcoran says he is inclined to believe him.
Could I speak to Mr. Corcoran myself?
He's in Brussels. But whatever you need, you can get through me.
I take a moment to select the right words. Look, there's something I was wondering.
What is it you want to know, Misha?
Somewhere during the past few minutes, Meadows began using my nickname, but she never quite asked permission. Perhaps Professor Garland is a bit too formal, but even Mallory Corcoran, who has known me all my life, calls me Talcott. Does the firm happen to have any clients with Excelsior in the name? I ask.
Why do you ask?
Call it a hunch.
Hold on, she says.
I hear the sound of a keyboard tapping and a mouse clicking, and then that distinctive blunk sound that Windows generates when it cannot find what you are looking for.
Nope.
She pauses, clicks again, types, waits, another blunk.
Not even in the confidential files.
After hanging up, I sit irresolutely, wondering how much I really want to know. But after what happened on the vineyard, the only reasonable answer is everything I can. So I call fellow professor Rob Saltpeter and ask him to try to set up an appointment for me when I'm in Washington at the end of the week. His contacts, in this case, are better than mine.
Sure, Misha, says Rob. Whatever will help.
But I detect in his voice, as in those of most of my friends lately, an emotion I have not previously encountered. Doubt. A gray autumn dusk is falling, and I am standing at the kitchen window, watching my son play. A little while ago, it finally occurred to me to try to reach just Alma down in Philadelphia, who predicted, in her confusing way, that people would be coming after me. But nobody seems to know how to reach her. Finally, I try one of her children, a social worker, who tells me that his mother always goes to the islands from December to March. He refuses, rudely, to give me a number for her, but does agree to pass along the message that I would like to speak to her. Bentley, chasing a pigeon, stumbles over a tree branch. Back in September, I began allowing him to venture alone into the backyard. Bentley was delighted. I have always believed in letting children explore, another hard lesson from the judge, who preached that a few fractures and bruises are a small price to pay for a sense of wonder and independence. One of my father's favorite applause lines was that the purpose of the state is not to create a society that is risk-free. His corporate audiences loved it because it implied less regulation of their products. His religious audiences loved it because it implied the fragility of our material lives. None of his audiences quite realized, I suspect, how important a catharsis it was for my father to believe what he was telling them. And all of it, like his hard-edged conservatism itself, went back to the death of Abby. Before Abby was killed, my father was already a favorite of conservatives, but only because he was, as somebody once said to his fury, a reasonable Negro, the kind of black man you might be willing to negotiate with. In the 60s, The judge was not yet the dour, distracted, somehow depressing man you no doubt remember from his regrettable confirmation hearings. Even after Abby's death, I have often thought his career might not have taken the bizarre direction that it did had he only experienced the emotional satisfaction of seeing her murderer. That was always the judge's word for the hit-and-run driver. Seeing her murderer caught and punished. But the police never found a suspect. The law had been the anchor of my father's faith, and the inability of the vast machinery of American justice to find a sports car that killed one little girl first bewildered him, then angered him. As his wrath mounted, my father spent more and more time locked in his study at Shepherd Street. I would listen fretfully at the closed door, not sure whether there was something I should be doing. I would hear him muttering to himself, possibly weeping, certainly drinking. And then, quite suddenly, the sea of melancholy in which the judge was drowning dried up. I never quite understood why. All I knew was that the will of which he had preached throughout our several childhoods reasserted itself. He drew a line, as Addison later explained it, and placed Abby and the mystery of her death on the side marked Past. He came roaring out of his study. He seemed himself once more, and would not admit his momentary weakness had ever existed. So when his old friend Oz McMichael, the cantankerous Virginia moderate, who sat in the Senate forever, lost his own son to a hit-and-run driver, and dared suggest that my father join his support group of parents whose children had been killed the same way, the judge curtly refused and, this is still according to Addison, stopped speaking to the man altogether.
"Misha, it's so good to see you. Come in, come in."
Wallace Warrington Wainwright steps to one side, beckoning me to join him in his inner office. As the door to the anteroom closes, it is just me and Wallace Wainwright. He is a tall man, at least 5 inches over 6 feet, with thinning brown-white hair and a pale, studied asceticism about his friendly face. He looks less like a judge than a friar, and if you sat next to him on an airplane, you would never take Wallace Wainwright for an associate justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. But that is how history will record him. Justice Wainwright is very much an insider, for he knows everybody. Everybody, that is, who matters in Washington. Small wonder that he, alone among the justices, attended my father's funeral. As I look around the room at his grand blue carpet and grander wooden desk, my eyes light upon his ego wall, a montage of photographs of the justice with everybody from Mikhail Gorbachev to Bob Dylan to the Pope. There is a photograph of a stern Wainwright in Marine dress uniform, and another frame holds his decorations. Wallace Wainwright puts a hand on my elbow and directs me to a plush blue sofa. He perches on a hard wooden chair, standing catter-corner to it. Over his shoulder, through the high window, is a view of the Capitol building. I am playing hooky this wet afternoon from the conference on tort reform that is paying the expenses for my visit to the city. Yet now that I am seated in Wainwright's chambers, the appointment arranged by Rob Saltpeter, who clerked for Wainwright years ago, I try to figure out how to begin. Wallace Wainwright waits. He can afford to wait, or not to wait, as he likes. He knows who he is. He sits at the summit of the legal world. Despite his impressive name, Wallace Wainwright comes, as the judge used to say in some astonishment, from no particular background. The Wainwright family, again according to my father, was Tennessee trailer trash. Associate Justice Wallace Warrington Wainwright, the intellectual giant, the man of the people, the last of the great liberal judges. And the closest thing my father had to a friend when they sat together on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, which is the real reason I have come. Despite their marked ideological differences, the two men were united in the belief that their minds were greater than those of the other judges on the court. Although my father was perhaps a decade older than Wainwright, They used to pal around outside the courthouse, too, playing golf and poker and fishing a bit, back before scandal destroyed my father's career. Even afterward, Wainwright tried to keep in touch, but eventually the strain on my father was too much. The judge was sitting still, even tumbling downward, and his old friend Wallace was still climbing the ladder. When the Democrats recaptured the White House, everybody knew that Wainwright would fill the first vacancy on the Supreme Court. Everybody was right. "It's good of you to see me," I begin.
"Nonsense," Wallace Wainwright huffs. "I'm just sorry we haven't had the chance to sit down in so long."
"It has been a long time," I agree.
"I understand you have a couple of children now. Or is it just the one?"
"Just Bentley. He's 3.
"A wonderful age," he says, filling the time with these irrelevancies.
"Nowhere to go but forward."
"Mr. Justice, I wanted to talk to you, if you are willing, about my father."
He raises his eyebrows in gentle inquisition. "About those last couple of years he spent on the bench before... well, before what happened."
"Of course, Misha, of course.
Charming as ever. Years ago, honoring his friendship with my father, I invited Wainwright to call me by my nickname, and he has never stopped."
"Those were difficult years. I cannot imagine what it must have been like for you, and I am so sorry about it all."
"Thank you, Mr. Justice. I know what your friendship meant to my father." Justice Wainwright smiles again.
"Oh, well, he was a very special man. A giant, an absolute giant. The finest judicial craftsman it has ever been my privilege to know."
A pause, now that he has made his little speech.
"Yes. So, what would you like to know?"
Here goes. "Well, I was wondering, not about the days after what happened, but the days before, when he was nominated in the first place, around then, what was going on, what it was like in the courthouse."
"What it was like?"
"Yes, whatever you feel you can share." Wainwright is drumming his fingers on the arm of the chair.
"I'll tell you, Misha, your father, well... at first, when Reagan announced that he was nominating him, nobody was entirely surprised, but still there was this excitement around the place. Your dad, well, he was always an impressive figure, but after the news was out, he kind of, when he walked down the hall, into the courtroom, wherever, it was kind of, well, breathtaking."
He drums his fingers a bit faster, then continues. "But not always. Even before the scandal broke, there were times when I would catch Oliver at an unguarded moment when he seemed strained, I suppose is the word. We would meet in the judge's elevator, and he would look tense, and I would ask him what was wrong. I would remind him he should be walking on air. Yes. And he would shrug and mutter about how anything can come out in these hearings. 'Look at Fortas,' he said one night when we went down to the garage together. 'The man takes perfectly legal money from a foundation, and they destroy him for it.'" Wainwright twists his mouth in prim distaste. I'm stunned. "You're not saying my father didn't
take money? Oh, no, nothing like that. I'm sorry, Misha, I didn't mean to leave that impression."
Wainwright actually laughs.
"Your father taking money? That's a real joke. No chance. None. I'm only trying to explain that your father was nervous, that he thought something would come out, something perfectly innocent, that would be distorted into something completely different."
"Did you have any idea at the time what that something might be?"
No, how could I? Your father was, what's the old phrase? Oh, yes, a man of transparent rectitude.
Nobody would have imagined that scandal could attach itself to such a man. Your father was a great man, Misha, no matter what happened. Justice Wainwright, if it's okay with you, I'd like to ask you about what happened, after the scandal broke. By all means. Do you remember the security logs from the hearings? How they registered all those visits from Jack Ziegler? He nods slowly. I wish I didn't. It was a sad moment. If it was sad for you, I almost say, think of how it felt for us. Until the logs showed up, I suppose I mostly believed my father's denials under oath of Jack Ziegler's visits. But I cannot say this to Wallace Wainwright. Yes, it was a very sad moment. But let me ask you a question. Do you believe my father was lying when he said he had not met Jack Ziegler at the courthouse? Wainwright is definitely nervous now. This is territory he would rather not cover. Misha, he begins, you have to understand, your father was in a difficult position. Obviously, he did not attach much attention to the courthouse visits. To him, the visits were innocent gestures of friendship. Innocent. Yes. I think he simply decided there was no sensible way of explaining them. That is, nothing that would make sense in that hearing room. So, of course, he denied the meetings. You're a semiotician. You know what I'm trying to say. Yes, your father did not mean that there were no meetings. He was denying the meetings as his critics were constructing them, not as he himself understood them. He notices something in my face. I'm sorry, Misha. I know this is not exactly the answer you wanted. I just want to understand. You're saying my father lied. When you cut away all the underbrush, that's it, right? He lied under oath. Wainwright sighs. Yes, Misha. I'm sorry. I do think your father lied. So Jack Ziegler was in the courthouse on, well, however many occasions it was. 3, I believe. My turn to see something in his face. You knew, I say softly, wonderingly. Wallace Wainwright sighs. Yes, Misha, I knew. I saw them together, as you say, not in the hallway, in the elevator, the private elevator for judges, late one night. And now I have to apologize again. You have come seeking assurance, and I cannot provide it. No, that's okay. I know my father lied. A pause. However, I need to understand something else. Of course, says Wainwright. When he met with Jack Ziegler, that was in the evening. Yes, fairly late, as I said. That was unusual, wasn't it? For my father to be at the courthouse so late? Unusual? He smiles. No, Misha, not at all. I worked long hours too, but nothing like Oliver. He was, you know the old phrase, a demon for details. For example, say there was a case in which one of the parties was obviously a dummy corporation, registered in, say, the Cayman Islands or Netherlands Antilles. Your father would demand that the corporation file, under seal, of course, a list of its actual owners. Or a public interest group? He would require a list of donors. I am, in spite of my mission, fascinated. He could do that? Well, not by himself. It would take an order from the panel hearing the case. Since the panel had 3 judges, 2 would have to agree to the request. But it was unanimous, at least in every case I can remember. A matter of intrajudicial courtesy, I suppose. And then I skip to the single question I am really here to ask. Justice Wainwright, this isn't easy. He makes a magnanimous gesture. I continue. A few minutes ago, you made a comment about, money. Let me anticipate you, Misha. You're wondering the same thing all those congressional committees wanted to know. If there was anything other than friendship between your father and Jack Ziegler, right? You're asking whether I think your father did little favors on the bench for his old roommate. You're asking, money aside, if he was a corrupt judge. Yes, sir. Yes, that's exactly what I'm wondering. Justice Wainwright frowns, drums his fingers on the table. I allow the moment to spin out. No, Misha. The answer is no. All those investigators, all those committees, all those journalists, none of them ever turned up anything. And the reason is that there was nothing to turn up. Your father was a man of enormous integrity. Please don't think for a moment that your father was doing anything corrupt. Your father would no more have sold his vote on a case than... A pause while he searches for just the right simile. Then a mischievous grin to tell me he has found it. Why, then I would. He finishes with a self-deprecating smile. I am almost done. One last bit of confusion to clear up. So, if my father was a man of such integrity and such intelligence, then why did he bring Jack Ziegler into the courthouse? He could have met with him anywhere. At home, at a golf resort, in a parking lot. Why take the risk? Wainwright's eyes grow soft and distant, and the sad little smile returns. You know, Misha, I never raised the question of Jack Ziegler with your father, but he raised it with me. We had dinner together. It must have been 6 or 8 months after he resigned from the bench. And he asked me what I would have done in his place. About Jack Ziegler. I told him that if I felt I had to meet with a friend who was in trouble, and if there was even a whiff of scandal about the friend, I would do it someplace private. Your father nodded. He seemed very sad. But this is what he said, Misha. I had no choice. I asked him what he meant, but he just shook his head and went on to another subject. Wainwright stops abruptly. Then he smiles sadly. Remember his greatness, Misha. That's what I try to do. 10 minutes later, I leave the building. Yes, Associate Justice Wallace Wainwright is an egomaniac. But it is that very ego on which I am counting. If Wainwright is willing to put my father in his own lofty company, then he surely believes what he says. Bottom line? The judge did not sell his vote to Jack Ziegler and his friends. So what was he doing? I know what Wainwright was trying to tell me at the end, even if he could not quite say the words. He thinks the judge brought Uncle Jack into his chambers because he wanted someone to see them together. He wanted, in short, to get caught. But if the justice is right, what did my father want to get caught at? The Tort Reform Conference is at the Washington Hilton Hotel and Towers. Following my meeting with Justice Wainwright, I do not return to the hotel directly. I am searching desperately for distractions. Instead, I have the taxi drop me on I Street to see a bookseller I know, who specializes in rare chess volumes. We chat about a few matters, then I stroll up L Street for a quick swing through Brooks Brothers. I buy a couple of pairs of socks. By the time I return to the Hilton, almost 4 hours have slipped past. It is nearly 8, and the streets of Washington are full dark. I have missed the final day of the conference, but I am sure I was not missed. The lobby is crowded with citizens of the darker nation, most of them in evening attire. I edge through them, my eyes on the elevators. I have decided to head upstairs to play chess on my laptop until I get sleepy, which is how I spend most evenings when I am away from home. And many when I am not. I weave through the happy multitude, now and then nodding at a vaguely familiar face. I have nearly reached the elevator bank when a pleasantly round shape, draped in an outrageously tight purple gown, detaches itself from a circle of laughing friends and strides purposefully in my direction.
Tal, I had no idea you were in town.
I stare in disbelief as Sarah Catherine Stillman, née Garland, materializes before me. Sally, I manage. What are you doing here?
What am I doing here?
Cousin Sally giggles and pats my cheek. Her eyes are slightly wild from whatever substance she is abusing this week.
I'm here for the fundraiser. The real question, sweetie, is what are you doing here?
The tort reform conference, I try to explain. It's just a bunch of law professors. I delivered a paper yesterday. Sally is peering at me closely. Her eyes shine wetly.
Are you all right, Talcott? You don't look so good.
I'm fine. Listen, Sally, it's nice to see you, but I really have to go. She ignores my brisk effort to escape as she conveys her own message.
I'm so glad I ran into you, Tal. I've been thinking about calling you.
Sally gets up on her toes to whisper in my ear.
Tal, listen. I need to talk to you about where I saw Agent McDermott before.
It takes me an awkward moment to recall that McDermott was the name used by the late Colin Scott. That Sally told me on the day I met him that she thought she knew him. I start to respond, but she cuts me off, her wine-soaked breath tickling the side of my face.
I saw him in the house, Tal, on Shepherd Street, years ago.
A pause.
He knew your father.
It was summer, Sally begins, sipping a bottle of beer from the minibar.
Maybe a year or two after Abby died.
She is lounging on one of the two double beds in my hotel room. I am seated at the tiny desk, the chair turned in her direction. I would rather not have this meeting in my room, but one look at her in the lobby made clear that she was in no shape to sit in a public place.
I was at your house, she says, on Shepherd Street. It was nighttime. I guess I was sort of asleep until the sound of an argument woke me up.
Where was I?
I think you were probably on the vineyard, you and your mom, maybe Mariah, but not your father, and not Addison. That's why I was over at your house. I was sort of with Addison, and I know how you feel about that.
Sally is a very dark woman, but she blushes anyway.
So anyway, that's why I didn't tell you before, about McDermott, I mean. I sort of pretended I didn't remember, but that wasn't true. I knew who McDermott was the minute I saw him.
I'm not judging you, Sally. I lie carefully. I just want to know what you remember about McDermott.
You are judging me.
And then she tells me the story.
The thing is, Tal, you have to understand, I would never have been in that house if I knew your father was going to be there. I was supposed to meet Addison, and we were supposed to be alone. Your father, well, he was supposed to be away.
She closes her eyes, frowns.
Not on the vineyard, though. I think he was supposed to be at some judge's convention. Anyway, I didn't know your father was around. I was supposed to see Addison. We were both just out of college, both in town for the summer. And he called me up and said everybody was away for a few days so we could spend some time together if I wanted. Well, I wanted. I told my folks I was going out with some girlfriends or something and not to wait up for me. Then I hopped on the 30 bus and then got on the S4. And well, anyway, I got to Shepherd Street and went up to the house, and Addison was there.
Pausing to see if I have any reaction. When I do not, she resumes.
Anyway, after a while, I fell asleep. I don't know how late it was. I know it was dark when these voices woke me up. Not loud, kind of whispery, but still angry. I mean, they were arguing, and maybe they were trying to argue quietly, but I still heard them. I realized there was somebody else in the house, and I sort of got scared. So I turned to wake up Addison, but he wasn't there. So I figured it must be Addison arguing with somebody. I thought it must be Uncle Oliver. So I put my clothes on. I figured I would sneak out the back door.
I glance at the digital clock on the nightstand. It is close to 10.
So I went down to the second floor and then went out into the hall. You remember there's this long landing. What do they call it?
The gallery.
Oh, right. And the gallery has this, this balustrade and the wooden posts that hold the balustrade. They're very wide, almost wide enough to hide behind. Anyway, the only light that was on was in your father's study, and the voices I heard were from inside the study. I couldn't make out what your father was saying, I think because he was trying to keep his voice down, but the other man was yelling, "That's not how the game is played," something like that.
He said the game?
That's what I said he said.
She pouts, not as prettily as she probably thinks, and continues.
Well, anyway, the other man, the man who was yelling, came out into the hallway, and he was pointing at your father, shaking his finger like he was angry or something. That's how I saw the birthmark, when his hand moved into the light. It was McDermott, the same man who was in the living room the week after your father died. And he was saying something like, "There are rules for this kind of thing." And then I heard Uncle Oliver's voice. You know, his lecturing tone. "There are no rules where a..." And then he said some word I couldn't quite understand. "Is involved." He sort of dropped his voice on that word I missed. Not because he thought anybody was listening. It was sort of like a hiss. But I kind of heard it, Tal, and I think it sounded like dollar. Like, "There are no rules where a dollar is involved."
They were arguing about money?
I don't know. I might not have it exactly right. And the other man, he was shaking his head like, "No." And then Uncle Oliver came into the light, and his face was wild. It was scary. I figured he had been drinking.
Sally gives me a long look, provocative and disconcerting. I do not want this woman in my room, but I have to have the rest.
Well, so anyway, now they were staring at each other. And then Uncle Oliver said, pretty loud, he almost shouted, "I'm sick of following the rules." Then the other man said something like, "That's not the way it's done." And then your father, his voice got real soft and cold, and he said, "You do it for Jack."
Meaning Jack Ziegler?
I think so. I don't know for sure. He didn't say the whole name.
You're sure it was the same man?
I'm sure, Tal. I remember the birthmark on his hand from when he was shaking his finger at Uncle Oliver. I remember the big white scar on his lip. It was the same man, Tal.
No rules where a dollar is concerned. That's what he said.
That's what he said. Sally confirms.
She yawns again. I can tell she is fading. And then I realize that a piece of the story is missing.
So where was Addison?
I ask.
No response.
Louder. Sally? Addison, Sally. Where was my brother when all this was happening?
Addison?
She snickers.
See, well, that's the thing. You know how the back stairs go down to that little hall behind the kitchen, right? Well, when I got down there, the kitchen was dark. I was going to go out through the mudroom. Well, I took about 2 steps, and then I bumped my shin on a stool, and I guess I was a little too loud or something, because the next thing I know, there's this hand over my mouth. I try to scream. I'm scared to death. And of course, it's your damn brother.
She shakes her head.
Addison.
She mutters, then nothing.
Sally?
Sally, what about Addison? What happened in the kitchen?
Well, he told me to hush. And I asked him, was he in the kitchen the whole time? And he asked me what whole time. And I said all the time your father was arguing with that white guy. And he said, what white guy? And I said, the guy who was talking to Uncle Oliver. And he said he didn't know what I was talking about. And then he said we had to get out of there fast. So we went on out the kitchen door, and, well, that was the end of that.
I have the sense that I'm missing something here.
Sally, listen, wake up. Sally, did you believe him? Did you believe Addison? About not hearing anything. Another snicker.
Believe Addison? Are you shitting me? That nigger never told the truth about anything in his life.
Sally's speech is growing less cultured as fatigue claims her.
He would say any damn thing to get what he wants, to get over.
Sally, listen, please, this is important, okay? Do you think Addison heard the argument?
Of course he did.
Are you sure? Sally? Only snoring. I decide to let Sally stay. Even if I could wake her, I can hardly send her home like this. Which means she will have to stay here in my hotel room and sleep it off. I go to the closet for an extra blanket, which I drape over Sally's somnolent form. I remove my tie, slip out of my shoes, and return to the desk chair to keep vigil. What a mess. If you drive along 7th Street near Howard University, you discover a little college town of remarkable complexity buried in the heart of Washington, D.C. After having seen Sally to a cab earlier that morning, it is to 7th Street that I go, on the last day of the conference, to have lunch with Lainey Cross, formerly Dr. Melanie Cross, F-A-C-O-G. Her late husband, Leander Cross, a prominent surgeon of the darker nation, was of my father's generation, but Lainey herself was something around 15 years younger, which puts her today in her late 50s. He was also one of my father's two real confidants. The other was my mother, during the difficult days after Greg Haramoto stepped forward. I took a taxi to Lainey's office, so she drives us over to a Cuban place that she loves. She has to be back at the office by 2, she tells me, so we will have to hurry. Around the time our appetizers run out, it is Lainey, finally, who brings us around to our purpose.
So, anyway, you said you wanted to talk about your father.
Yes, anything you're willing to tell me that your husband told you about my father.
What Leander told me about your father?
Yes.
All of it?
Not all of it, but thinking back to, well, when my father was nominated to the Supreme Court and had all that trouble.
There isn't that much to tell, she says.
Please, I say, anything you can remember.
You haven't told me why, Talcott.
And indeed, I have not. I realize that what I say has to be good. Because I think my father wanted you to tell me, I say. This gets her attention. Her wise eyes flash at me. He left me a note, I explain. Lainey Cross does not ask me what the note said. She merely nods her slim head, perhaps in resignation.
Tal, you know this might not be easy for you to hear.
I know that, but I think I need to hear it. She is unhappy.
Tal, you understand, my Leander was a surgeon, not a psychiatrist. But, well, okay. You want to talk about what happened after the hearings. Fine, I'll tell you.
And she does, straight out, no frills.
Leander told me he thought your father had a breakdown.
A breakdown? What does that mean, a breakdown?
You know what it means.